The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Argentina.
Okay, 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2. That's good. That's good. Okay, I'm recording
as well.
We're
already up to episode 10.
Hello again, and welcome back to Spin the Rally Pod, your rally fix in times of lockdown. I'm Lisa O'Sullivan, the rally fan, and as always, the motor mouths with the knowledge join me from splendid isolation across the UK. That's former team boss George Donaldson, Dirtfish senior staff writer David Evans, and the voice of rally himself, Colin Clark. Good afternoon, chaps.
Good afternoon, Lisa.
It's great. I feel like a teacher. We are in lockdown and so many people are being teachers to their children. So that's what you've been doing for most of the day, isn't it, Colin?
Yeah, I have. No, my kids are back to school. Back to school this week, which wasn't back to school, but it was back to the living room table. It's basically...
Can you imagine back to school with Colin? Sorry to jump in.
No, that's actually beyond any man's or woman's comprehension.
What do you mean, boys?
Sorry, Colin, I was quite good at school.
I was quite good at school.
When you say nothing personal, David, that is pretty much as personal as you're going to get, really, isn't it?
Absolutely. And moving on from Colin's afternoon, I've got to talk about my afternoon, which is far more interesting, very exciting. Tap, tap, tapping away. And my wife and the children come running in to tell me that we have a visitor in the back garden. The visitor was being shepherded through the garden by the cat, the family cat called Twinkle. And it was a duck, a duckling, a tiny, tiny duckling.
Oh.
So Twinkle was a little bit nervous and kind of whacked it over the head a couple of times, but then didn't want to get too close because clearly it was about to be pecked. And then the thing just disappeared into the bushes and reappeared half an hour later at the front door and just sat on the doormat.
This better have a happy ending.
It's not going to have a happy ending, Lisa, let's be honest. It's going to arrive in the house, in the cat's mouth.
It's an ongoing drama. It's an ongoing drama because currently the birds, and actually I could take you outside and get you some bird noises because we've put one of them in a box and then another one arrived.
Wow.
And so he's with his mate. So we've now got two ducklings, and they are tiny. They just about fit in your hand, but we have no idea what to do with them.
Well,
so
we've found
alien,
them. It's
alien homicide. That's what this is.
Where's mummy duck?
That's going to kill it.
He looks everywhere.
Right.
What?
Right. Give Kate Humble a ring. Kate Humble will know what to do. She knows what to do in all circumstances.
Well, the thing is, with ducks, they imprint fairly quickly after they hatch. So if they haven't seen their mum, you are now mum.
Mum.
Wow. Or Twinkle. That's
quite
Twinkle
a responsibility,
is mum,
isn't it?
I've always wanted a pet duck.
How small are these ducklings, David?
They would fit in your hand. And we put them both in the box.
That's a shame.
And they're trying to flap their wings. Oh. And they're trying to jump out of the box now. So I've got some pictures. I tell you what, we'll put a picture on our social media channels of the ducks, and maybe somebody could suggest a name for the ducks. Maybe
not David, but by the time the pictures go up, the ducks will be dead. Let's face it.
Colin.
They will be dead, mate.
No. You know, David, I'm on your side. Save the ducks.
Let's get them their own Facebook account and tell us.
Well, at least they're not on a rally stage, because let's face it, any wildlife on a rally stage usually doesn't hang around for long. Argentina. No. We're going to talk about Argentina. That's our motive today. And I am going to keep an eye on the clock. you guys. You need to get all of this into 45 minutes today, not an hour and 10 minutes, which is how long it took us to talk about the second part of Sebastian Ogier's career, even though we said...
Well, hurry up and ask a question then.
Argentina. Lisa, we should be preparing for Argentina. We should be getting ready for Argentina. I've never been to Argentina. I have always been back in the studio hearing tales of how great the steak is and how we need to have some more Malbec and, wow, what a brilliant place it is. It's like being on the moon. I feel like I've missed it, and I'm going to miss it again this year.
Well, I first went in 1990. That was my first visit.
Gosh, you must have been...
Nobody can compete with that.
40?
And it was in July in 1990, and we all left here in summer, and we'd asked our team manager at the time was Jürgen Bertel. And he just said, "Oh, your normal clothes will be fine. Everything will be good. You know, take a winter jacket or whatever, but that'll be fine." We got there to Buenos Aires, where we're waiting for all the sea freight. There was about four of us arrived a little bit ahead of everybody else. It was a late call to go there with Carlos, and our second driver was Jorge Ricaldi.
Oh,
and his co-driver was Martin Christie, whom I formed a lifelong friendship with. I'm hoping that somebody's listening from Argentina, maybe even Martin himself, and. We were waiting for all the parts to arrive in this garage in Buenos Aires, and there was ice. It was frosty. Every morning was frosty. And so we ended up having to get the team doctor to bring a whole load of thermal clothes. Because by the time you get up to Cordoba in the mountains, we were seeing -5, -6 in snow. It was amazing. But absolutely shocking.
That was nothing, though, was it, compared to, it was 83, the year after the Falklands, which obviously it didn't run in 82 because of the Falklands War, but in 83 they moved it, because it used to be based in Tucumán for the first 2 years. Clearly somebody's written a few features about Rally Argentina.
yes, indeed.
and then...
Hang on, Patagonia, they speak Welsh in
south.
Patagonia,
it
don't
started
they?
In Buenos Aires, drove through the night to, I can't remember the name of the place, but it stopped there and then did 2 days out of Bariloche, which is where that ski resort, isn't it? Properly in the Andes and just a beautiful part of the world. And I've just finished writing another piece about the trip that Colin and I say we're going to take every single year haven't taken to Tierra del Fuego and Patagonia, which for me, I have to say, I would just love to get down there.
Patagonia, they speak Welsh in Patagonia, don't they?
They do, in parts of...
Tiny village and one tiny part, they probably do,
But it's not just tiny, George. There are quite a few thousand people that speak fluent Welsh. And it's it's obviously a South American version of Welsh, but it's you're only talking, I think, 100 years ago. I think the 100th anniversary of that... Yeah. That what was it? It was like an expedition, wasn't it? It was basically that's quite. Should I tell that story or not about how that came about?
Tell that story.
Very quickly. There was obviously the Welsh are a bit like the Scots. They're an incredibly patriotic, very nationalistic nation. And about 100 or so years ago, there was a feeling. There was a feeling that perhaps Welshness was disappearing. That the ruling Westminster Parliament were perhaps doing their best to, a bit like the Highland Clearances in Scotland, to get rid of Welshness. So there was one fellow who was very charismatic, and he had an awful lot of influence over a number of communities in Wales. And he said, well, we're going to start a new Wales. We're going to go and we're going to preserve the Welsh character, the Welsh culture, the Welsh language, but we're going to do it in an entirely different country, free of any outside influences. Let's all go to Argentina. And remarkably,
this is the Welsh
remarkably,
equivalent of the Pilgrim Fathers, then.
Exactly. Many, many thousands of proper Welsh people got on the boat, went down to Buenos Aires, they headed across the Pampas, up into the mountains, pushing a piano, the first lot of them, and they settled pushing a piano, and that piano's still about, apparently. And they settled, as you say, in Patagonia, Elise. And to this day, there is still a very, very strong Welsh culture, Welsh language in that part of Patagonia. It's quite incredible. And our friend Emir Penlan, who worked on the radio with us, Lisa, he produced a couple of really, really good pieces for Welsh television from that part of the world a few years ago. There we go. That's my first useless
you know,
story
most,
of the day.
The most interesting bit of that story was the piano bit.
That was interesting, I have to say.
Yeah, I'm sure I've seen a movie about that, but I think it was based in New Zealand and someone lost their fingers.
So if we were going to be heading off towards Argentina at this stage of the year, and obviously we'd have to ignore any results that had gone beforehand, if we were going out there to Argentina, who would we be expecting to impress us on the stages?
Well, according to Colin,
absolutely. But equally, from what Colin just said, it would only be Alvin Evans, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Well, it's difficult, though. I mean, trying to get a piano into that Toyota is not going to be easy. I'm sure that's going to slow it down.
You could do it behind
you. The one guy who would he struggle? Does he struggle anywhere? Is Sebastian Ogier, who, of course, famously has never won in Argentina. Despite starting something like 10 times there, he's never won it. He's come close on a few occasions, but never quite done it. And I reckon we know Sebastian quite well, and we know that he is a driver who doesn't really enjoy the ruts. He doesn't enjoy that kind of movement in the car at high speed. And you get a lot of that, don't you, George, on the second run of stages in Argentina?
You do. It ruts out. You get the tram lines.
And you've got to have complete confidence. I'm not saying that he doesn't always have complete confidence. Of course he does. But some drivers are just a little bit more nervous, aren't they, in those kind of conditions?
Yeah, it's a pretty hairy experience. The worst I've ever experienced is in Sweden like that, and it is horrendous.
George, can you tell us what the conditions are like in Argentina when the teams are preparing for this? And as you've mentioned, the weather can be frosty, it can be wet, it can be dry, and it can be really quite terrifying.
In some ways, a mixed bag. Rallies in the past have been won because the first car on the road got a dust-free run. I mean, it's as simple as that. We've had teams in the past going through and watering the stages down. They've employed water tankers and they've gone through in front of their cars to try and damp the stage down so that their car running number two on the road wouldn't be so badly dusted by the car number one on the road, which I have to say was a Toyota Didi Oriole. When Didi won in, was it 98? 98, I think Didi won there. I think that's right. He won by only a handful of seconds from Carlos, I think it was.
George.
I spectated that whole stage from an airplane at 15,000 feet. Amazing.
But that was when your pilot was awake and not asleep. George, there's a fantastic picture.
That was a different pilot that year.
There's a fantastic picture appeared this week of you. I think it was one of the McLean pictures of you in Oriel's rally-winning Toyota, trying to move it, I think, from the ceremonial finish. Was that Argentina or not? Where was that? Did you see that picture?
I think that was probably Spain.
Right.
Did he won there in 1998?
I thought it was 98 the picture was
and
from.
He wasn't nominated. He wasn't nominated as a driver.
Right.
He was incapable of producing any results that year of any decent results. I think he won Argentina, having said that. He was struggling anyway, and we decided not to nominate him, and we nominated Freddie Loix instead.
Wow.
And so we nominated Freddie and Carlos. Carlos, I think, retired. Freddie had a great drive to second place and Didi won. There you go.
That's quite remarkable.
What can you say?
David,
very annoying.
David, while we're talking about Argentinian, things that go on in Argentina, for me, one of my biggest memories, a couple of huge memories that I'll tell you about later, but one of my biggest memories of Argentina was Hayden Padden's win there. And in particular, that performance on El Condor, that last, because it was a last stage win for Padden, wasn't it? And that was obviously Seb Ogier that he beat. Everyone expected Ogier to take the win in Argentina. At the start of that stage, I think the odds would have been massively odds on for Ogier to win that stage because he was, he was in the better car. He was the better driver without any doubt. He had more experience. He was going to win that stage. And then we saw from Padden one of the greatest single-stage performances we have seen from any driver anywhere. But we never really quite got to the bottom of why Ogier seemed to be a little bit off on that stage. Did you ever manage to work it out?
No, Yeah, exactly right. So I think there was only a couple of seconds after Mina Clavero, the stage before the penultimate stage. And then, I mean, Ogier wasn't even second quickest, was he? He dropped like 10 or 12 seconds or something. It was a huge amount. And there's part of me that thinks, you know, was he in? He was obviously leading the championship then. Did he give that? I thought, I don't remember any moments or anything for him. And I'm sure, you know, he pushed to the absolute maximum, but the time just didn't happen. But equally, you know, that moment, every now and then you get drivers that can elevate themselves. And that happened. That's definitely what happened with Padden. He was so fired up going into that day. We've talked about this before on a podcast about that argument that him and Ogier had the night before in service. And it really, really fired Hayden up. And I think you're quite right. You know, he never drove a better stage than El Condor. And it is one of the most complicated and tricky and horrible and nasty and twisty and just a real nadgery stage. Yeah. And we've all been over there. And to try and make time or to try and defend a position there, you know, going 10 tenths. You know, we saw Elvin, didn't we, in 17. He literally touched the bridge with the left rear and lost the event by 7 tenths of a second or something. It was to do that, what he did to Ogier was phenomenal. And, you know, the greatest moment of Padden's career.
Without any question. And do you know what
So far, sorry, yes, quite.
Yeah, you know, we mustn't forget Padden is working on various projects, and we might well see him back at some point. I'm not convinced we will, but we might. But what was really telling about that stage win was the interviews with Padden afterwards, David, and the fact that he had actually put a massive amount of effort into that stage before Rally Argentina in terms of studying the onboards, preparing with some very elusive mind guru from Norway, I think it was, wasn't it? He'd employed the services of some bloke to help him visualize, to help him maximize his performance in the stage. You know, and if he told us that before...
Did it work?
Yeah, clearly it works. You know, he absolutely annihilated them. You know,
Where...
Go on.
That was where Padden was just brilliant, though. You know, he looked and he took everything from the periphery of everything and pulled it in, didn't he? You know, he wasn't just naturally talented. You know, he worked massively hard on his fitness, as they all do. The nutrition, your psychology, everything. There was that... he used the guy from the All Blacks, Gilbert. I can't remember his Christian name, but I made the huge mistake of saying to Hayden once, "Are you still using that Gilbert guy from the All Blacks?" And he said, "Yeah, mate, it's Gilbert." Gilbert Anoka, was it? I don't know. I can't remember. But, you know, I mean, that was the level that he took it to. And did it brilliantly. And I have to say, one of my abiding memories of that is I always have got on really well with Hayden, but particularly well with John Keenard, who's such a lovely guy. I went to the final service, of course, and everybody was cheering. It was all brilliant and blah, blah, blah. And then the car was just leaving, and it was a slight panic because the celebrations had gone on a little bit and they'd got to get to the ceremonial finish. And so I turned to sort of run out of the way. And just at that point, John was running to get into the car, and I was carrying my retractable pencil in my hand, and I stabbed him in the chest with some extreme force. Ooh. And poor John was left limping into the car. So I've apologized on numerous occasions, John, and I would just like to say sorry again for stabbing you on the best day of your career.
What do you do to co-drivers you don't like, then?
You don't want to know, George.
Do you take your notes with retractable pencils, David?
Yeah, always. Ooh. Always. 0.5 thingy lead. Holding one right
basically,
now.
It's basically the equivalent of you, Lisa, with your wax rolls. When you're doing your recording, you always use a wax roll backup. Old Edison, you know. It's the same thing. Yeah.
Well, actually saying that, of course, that takes me to the old NASA joke about how much the Americans spent on creating a pen that could write upside down or could write in zero gravity, and the Russians used a pencil.
Yeah. Fabulous.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it. But George, what would you say is your favourite memory of Argentina, or what's the best story you've not been allowed to tell anyone before now that you can just tell us?
Gosh. There's so many. Argentina is great. First of all, just to let people get a bit of an imagery about the place, when I first went there, it was like, so I would have been mid-30s. It was like stepping back into your childhood. Everything looked old-fashioned and like my childhood in Scotland. It just was. It was, you know, the street lights were old-fashioned. The roads were concrete. We still had concrete roads in some parts of Scotland before they started asphalting everything. So it was just, it had this unique feel. Carlos Paz doesn't feel terribly different when you come down off the main highway down into where all the hotels are. The same fantastic old feel. Mm. And, you know, you'd be driving down there over these little funny crossroads and a go-kart, like a proper little
George.
Go-kart, I'll go flying over the road at 70 miles an hour. In front of you, it's terrifying.
Do you know what I'm envisaging now?
Kids with no helmets. Tell me.
What I can see right now is exactly that crossroads coming off of the main road.
Yeah.
And it was
you
driving.
I think it was you when that one happened.
It was you driving. Yeah. You were driving the Subaru minibus, Mackinnon and Solberg in the back, me in the passenger seat, and we were late for the press. Right. It was my very, very first proper rally. I'd been to Monte Carlo, which, yeah, was a proper rally, but it was my first rally as a sponsor's representative. And I'd literally just arrived. And we were staying in the hotel across the other side of the lake. Almost opposite was HQ, where the press conferences were. But it was quite a long way around. And we were late. And in those days, the fines were massive if you were late for the press conference. I just remember closing my eyes, George, as we went through a culvert across a six-way crossroads with Mackinnon and Solberg in the back at about 120 kilometres an hour. It was terrifying. It was utterly terrifying.
I'm a very careful driver when I've got, like, you know, 12 million quid's worth of driver in the back. I would know the junction quite well, Colin. I'm sure I was being suitably... I would drive... I adopt local driving practices in order to survive locally, which is great in Argentina because the local driving practices are quite cavalier, I think is the expression.
A time limit of liabilities. I can't remember what that's called when you can't be prosecuted, George, so you can just be honest that you were rallying a minibus.
Oh, right, okay, I was rallying a minibus. No, I wasn't, I really wasn't. So in terms of incredible events, I don't know, I remember pulling a rally on a recce. I remember pulling a rally driver in a rental car. His car was broken and the front strut had broken on it. And we tried to repair it three times and it fell off. And I ended up putting a really short, like a 10-foot chain on the back of the MAN truck that I had. This was back, it must have been 1991 or something.
And
the driver was Mohammed bin Sulayem. The co-driver was Mr. McNamee, Ronan McNamee. And I pulled them out of there about 60, 70, 80 kph through this little gravel road, which was, it was one of the lower stages, not the El Condor stages, but
Santa Rosa stage maybe.
We just wore the engine away. We wore the front of the car away, pulling it out because it was on the way to get it out. That was fun.
I remember though, George. Sorry to have interrupted you there, but a story suddenly came to me that you have to tell, and that was the. Night before the final day in 93 when Mr. Nicky Grist suggested that you should put some petrol in the van.
Well, we started a bit of a, I was at that time I was team coordinator, and that one of my jobs was to be in the communications aircraft, something that I maintained when I became team manager at times, although the relay stations became better. So I was driving from Carlos Paz to the airport every morning and I would drop off the drivers on the way. And I had a brand new Peugeot 505, I think it was, but the fuel gauge didn't work. And the other team members had been using this before I got given it, just literally at the start of the rally. So I said, how much fuel's in it? Nobody knew. So I went and filled it up at the petrol station, right up to the top. Gauge is still not working fine, not a worry. I know it's full now, driving backwards and forwards to the airport, 40 kilometres. On the Saturday night, so Nicky was a late stand-in, I think, at that point. Was that the point that he was?
Late
stand-in for Juha Kankinen because Pirro had a stroke.
Yeah.
So now last day of the rally. It was probably a four-day event at that point. Second last day of the rally, we're driving back to the hotel, and I'd already spoken to Juha about the fact that the fuel gauge didn't work and we could have a bit of a wind-up on Nicky. And I'd also spoken to Didier and Bernard Ocelli, and we said, okay, we'll craft the wind-up. So on the way back to the hotel on that, effectively, it wouldn't have been a Saturday night because the rally probably ran during the week, but I said to Nicky, I said, Jesus, we're a bit low on fuel here. I better fill this up. I think we'll get back to Carlos Pass. And Nicky said, look, stop and get fuel on the way down. We don't mind. We don't want to run out on the way to the hotel. And I said, no, I'll do it later. Don't worry. So I dropped him at the hotel, and Nicky admonished for me to go and fill it up. And I went away and did whatever I had to do. And of course, didn't fill it up. I think actually I did fill it up just to make absolutely sure. And it only took about 15 litres. Anyway, in the morning, we're driving away, and Nicky, we were just driving out of Carlos Pass. So if you can imagine, we're going back to Cordoba. You drive out of Carlos Pass on a dual carriageway, all traffic lights. You pass the last petrol station before Cordoba. It's about 25, 30 k's to Cordoba. You turn to go up a steep hill. Just before we turned to go up the steep hill, I said, oh, Juha. I said, I forgot to get petrol last night. It's pretty low. Maybe I should go back. And Juha, just as cool as a cucumber, looked across at the gauge. He said, it's not off the red yet, George. It'll be okay. It'll be fine. And I said, it's nearly off the red, Juha. No, it'll be fine. Just keep going, George. It's okay. And Nicky, who was in the middle at the back, leaning forward and looking at this gauge, George, why didn't you fill it up? And he was getting quite agitated. I said, it'll be okay, Nicky. You know, I mean, if it runs out on the way up the hill, we'll be able to freewheel back down and get fuel. And it's about a 2 kilometre climb out this hill, quite a steep hill. And it's sort of like a motorway at this point now. So we went up the hill, and I'm accelerating like mad up this hill, and we got quite near the top, and I just jerked the throttle a couple of times. Oh, that's it. So I swerved the car a little bit. Oh, and it picked up again, and away we went. Nicky's going, turn around. But you couldn't, because there was a concrete barrier, and we didn't have that much time anyway, you know, to get to the Parc Fermé. So on we went, and I went about another 5 or 6 k's, and it was fine, and I was leathering on. You know, I'd be doing about 120, 130 kph, and Nicky's saying, go a bit slower, you know, preserve the fuel. It'll be fine, Nicky, it'll be fine, don't worry. And then we're about halfway, and I did it again, and we did it again, and we pretended it was running out. Nicky was in the back. He was basically catatonic, muttering to himself by the time we'd finished this 25-minute
journey.
We should
point out, George, here, that Nicky and Juha were leading.
They were leading. Oh yeah, it was Nicky's first chance for a win. So he wanted to be angry, but between Bernard and Didi, who were flanking him in the seat, they were saying, "Don't worry about it, Nicky. It's a lovely place. Someone will stop and pick us up. They love the rally. We'll get there, okay? It's fine, George. Don't worry about it." And you was in the back, and Nicky couldn't understand why everyone was being so cool about it. But I started to play a bit nervous. I said, oh, guys, you know, maybe we should try and go into the town and get some fuel. No, we'll get stuck and we won't be on rally route. And it just was such a drama. Well, we got down. We spluttered our way. We were really quick crafted about it. We spluttered our way into the park for me. Nicky was, he had actually had tears in his eyes, and he wouldn't deny the fact he had tears in his eyes. He was so relieved. He literally had to be carried out the car. And I got out the car as well. And he said, well, you know, what are you going to do now? You've got to get to the airplane. And I said, ah, Nicky, I said, don't worry. It's absolutely full. We were just winding you up, jumped back in the car and drove away. His face, he literally collapsed. He was being held up by Didi and Juha as I drove away. Gee whiz, it was a good wind-up. It really was.
And how did he perform
it
that?
It was cruel. Nicky is one of the most wonderful co-drivers to work with. Very, very professional, very diligent, contributes massively to the team. And that's one of the nicest things about so many of the co-drivers. They are brilliant to work with. They contribute to the team. They work with you. Nicky was very rude about you
that day, though, George.
he wasn't actually. You know, he accepted the wind-up was in good faith, and obviously I had everybody in on it.
But I've got to just jump in here and follow that one up. I had a brilliant interview with Nick a couple of years ago about this event. And, of course, he did go on to win his first ever WRC win. And so the amazing bit about that event was straight after Argentina in 93, he and Juha were flying straight to Auckland for Rally New Zealand. So Nicky said in those days, you know, he didn't drink a lot, and you know, he was still very diligent in trying to make his way in the sport and everything. So they'd done the celebration in Villa Carlos Paz, or Cordoba, I think it was.
It usually went on to Buenos Aires, let's be honest. It was a celebration. It was so good.
So the next day, the day after the event finished, they were going to Buenos Aires to fly to Auckland, which was sort of the day after. So they'd got a night in Buenos Aires. So Nick said they went into this lovely hotel. There was Juhar, Timo, who was Juhar's brother, who did gravel notes for them, and Nick. And they checked into the hotel, and Juhar was like, right, straight up, get changed, and we'll go out for something to eat. We'll take you to this amazing restaurant. So off they went to this amazing restaurant. And Christy said there was a bottle of red, then another. And the drinking just carried on. And that was when the evening that he discovered Fernet Branco, which is an Italian liqueur that is very popular in that part
lethal
of the world. So on and on and on. And eventually they got back to the hotel. And Nick said as they were going up to their rooms, he said to Juhar, we're checking out at 10 sharp. Got to get to the airport, get on the plane to Auckland. Yeah, no problem. So Christy's downstairs at 10 and in walks Juhar. Look, this is all a real shame. So we're hoping to do a podcast with Nick, and I'm actually stealing one of his best stories, but we'll ask him to tell us in his inimitable way. So he gets there, and Juhar walks in, and Nicky said he didn't look too bad, and he was quite surprised. And he said, morning, and Juhar turns to the receptionist, name Kankeran, come to check out. So the guy's like, yeah, fine, and is anything from the minibar, sir, Mr. Kankeran? And Nicky said there was a pause, and Kankeran said, I left you the light bulb. and him and his brother had emptied too many bars.
That would be you, huh?
And then off they went and got on the plane to go over the South Pole to Auckland.
I did that route once. It was quite an interesting flight.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well,
you stop down in Tierra del Fuego, the airplanes, or wherever. I think it's Tierra del Fuego. The airplane stops at some big airbase, airbase, and then you fly. Effectively, you go right over Antarctica, not obviously over the South Pole, but you go right out over Antarctica. At that time, it was one of the longest flights that you could do. I timed it, I think, at 14 hours 45 minutes, and that's in a classic 747. But I hasten to say that the aircraft was half empty, and I dare say that every single fuel tank on it was bunged full.
Mm.
And we stopped in Christchurch, which was the first place for us to be able to stop. 14 hours, 45 minutes.
There is something about the Southern Hemisphere events. You know, there's an element of sort of romanticism about them. But it was the same when we went to Chile for the first time last year. You know, that journey through the Andes. And it was great. And Argentina, for me, is always, from the minute you touch down in Buenos Aires, it's always an adventure. It is
an adventure. I actually find, because obviously...
I want to know what your best stories are from Argentina.
Well, one of mine, Lisa, I mean, Facebook is a great thing for pinging back Facebook memories. And a picture appeared yesterday, I think it was, in my memories of an incredible road that I took maybe, crumbs, I think it was 8 years ago now, 9 years ago, when I flew into Santiago and took the bus to Carlos Paz. To do that, you have to cross the Andes. And that was some trip. But it's like you say, David, it is an adventure. The whole thing is an adventure. Getting there, once you're there, it's an adventure because, you know, the fans are so different. They're so enthusiastic. They're so absolutely committed to their rallying. And, you know, one of my best memories, again, goes back, George, it's a story involving you and the minibus again. But it was the first time, again, that I was there, 2002. I was there as a sponsor, not as a media person. And I think it was after the press conference, we had the ceremonial start in the centre of Carlos Paz. So I'm still in the minibus with you. And we drove down from the Puerto del Lago Hotel into the centre of Carlos Paz, and the crowds were just phenomenal. There were people hanging out of windows. They were five deep on balconies. They were 10 or 15 deep in the street. And there was obviously a street that they kept open for the cars and the drivers to come to the ceremonial start. And we drove up in the minibus, and I'm in the passenger seat, and we stop, and I'm taking in all these crowds, a little bit awestruck. And George says, well, just get out and open the door so that Tommy can get out the back, because he's in the back of the sliding door. So I jump out and I pull the sliding door to, and Tommy's face appears from the back of this minibus. And my good God, at that point, I thought, I know what it must feel like to be a rock star, because the noise from the crowd when they saw Tommy coming out of this minibus, it was just, it was deafening. It was tens of thousands of people in complete adulation of Tommy Mackinnon. And it was one of those moments that stays with you. It makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck at the time, and makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck when you think about it. They're just special. It's the combination of everything, isn't it? It's the culture out there. It is the scenery. It's the stages.
The atmosphere.
It's the atmosphere, and it's the fans. But I think the fans, more than anything, make the rally.
I did the Condor thing a couple of years ago, actually, with Scary, our friend Gary Osborne, who was filming for Citroën, and the two of us went. And obviously we had some media credentials, so we could jump through a few roadblocks to get up on, because, you know, we've driven through there, Colin, you know, two or three, four nights before the event goes up there. You know, it's through there on a Sunday. We've been over there on, say, the Wednesday or the Thursday, and it's packed. It's already packed. You can't find the best place to park your tent or whatever. But Scary and I went up during the event, and oh my good Lord, it is something else. It's everything you hope it will be. You know, the people selling bread, you know, walking up and down selling their warm bread, and just, you know, everywhere you turn, people are offering you either a beer or, you know, a steak sandwich or some of that weird stuff that they, what is that tea thing that they make in the, remember in the little cup?
Yeah, Matty.
Yeah, Matty. No, I didn't try any of that. But I have to say, that the actual bit of watching the cars, it is the best place in the world to watch. You know, the anti-lags bouncing off the rocks, and it's just phenomenal. And it's freezing cold first time through there, because, you know, you're up 2,100 meters or something, and it feels like you are literally on the moon. And then you sort of walk back through the crowds. And I did this, and you get to where the sort of business end of sleeping in the mountains for 3 or 4 days. And it was really quite unpleasant. You know, if you were thinking of doing it, I would give it a second thought. It was quite fetid over the back there. But still, you know, we got back to the car, we drove out and stopped at this cafe in El Condor, which is kind of a small kind of hamlet thing. And just had, you know, what was actually the worst cup of coffee I've ever had, and a sweet pastry thing, but it didn't matter. You know, walked out of there and the condors were circling overhead. It was magical, absolutely magical. It's a proper sort of pinch yourself moment to be there. It was, and that's what, you know, the likes of Sardinia, you know, not to decry Sardinia, all of these great events are great, but there is something special about somewhere like Argentina.
Absolutely. It is magical. It is a film set. It's real life. It's, you know what makes it? It's just the people. Argentine people are just so fantastic, so welcoming, so warm, so friendly, and they eat so well. My God. Four or 5 hour lunches are normal, and I enjoy my 4 or 5 hour lunch after the rally in Buenos Aires. Every year I've been for about the last 5 or 6 times I was there with Matt the Sat. We were managing a 4 or 5 hour lunch in Buenos Aires the day after the rally.
They are fantastic people, but it's the only place in the world where I have ever been mugged for a fake Rolex.
There's one Argentinian person who's not great, and he's the git of a taxi driver who ripped me off not once but twice on the journey back to the airport. But apart
I have
from
been
that,
ripped off by a taxi driver in Buenos Aires as well. You've got to be a bit careful of them. Yeah.
Probably the same one.
Yeah, probably is just the same guy. We've been targeted. Discriminatory, that is.
Yeah, but no,
anyway,
it is.
Great place.
We are kind of heading towards the end of time here. As a rally fan who has never been to Argentina, and I'm going to have to wait a little bit longer for the chance to head out to Cordoba and enjoy everything that you've spoken about. As a novice rally fan, what advice would you give to someone who is preparing to go to Argentina for the first time next year?
I would absolutely...
What do I do? What do I
have
see?
Have a
what
salad
do I
every third day. Put don't your worry meat about the rest of it.
Put your meat-eating trousers on.
Yeah. I was going to say, eat plenty of veg before you leave, because you won't eat any veg when you're out there.
I have to say that the first time I went for a meal, we ordered my friend, myself, and my colleague Andy Burnett. We both ordered T-bone steaks, and the guy said, "Oh, I'll bring you the meat and let you see it. Look, it's okay. We're from Scotland. We know what a T-bone steak looks like. Just bring us a couple of T-bone steaks." Well, these steaks arrived. They must have been 2.5 kilos each. They were 2.5 inches thick, and they must have been 400 millimeters long, and I don't know, 350 millimeters wide. I was so embarrassed.
How did you dream that night?
I can't remember dreaming. I managed to eat half of the steak. Andy, he ate pretty well all of it. I don't quite know, but he was ill the next day. We were both basically not eating the next day. We were off food. But the other fabulous thing there, when you go there, Lisa, a submarino. It's the Argentine version of a hot chocolate. A hot chocolate.
George, I was so disappointed.
Very warm
you built
and
this
give
up
you a
the
bar
first time
chocolate.
I was there. You built it up
Submarino's
and then it was so disappointing.
It's absolutely great. It's absolutely great. It's unusual, but it's nice.
There's two other things. Empanadas, which are perfect little Argentinian pasties. And everything has to be consumed with a glass of Malbec, a large one. Actually, there is one other thing that's brilliant, and that's in the Porto de Largo, the hotel where the whole thing is based around, a cheese and ham toasty.
Brilliant.
But do you know what I like?
I love
Do you know, I've got a theory. I have a theory about cheese and ham toasties, that wherever you go in the world, you will always be able to get a cheese or ham or a cheese toasty. And ham toasty.
Yeah. That's classic.
Yeah. After a fashion, you're absolutely right. So, yeah, so much to experience there. Such a fantastic place. Beautiful scenery.
Don't forget the dogs. Dogs.
Dogs are lovely.
Everywhere. Everywhere.
Rally dogs.
Rally dogs.
Yes, as dogs, we used to dogs, hear quite often part, at again, Stage End from you,
part
Colin.
Of the, part of the thing from my childhood, people used to just let their dogs out. You're not allowed to do that these days, I guess, in this country. But in Argentine, everyone lets their dogs out. Dogs roam around and eventually come back for their dinner, I guess.
I'm pretty sure there's a place in Argentina where all the dogs basically all meet
Buenos
up.
Aires.
They let them out at the end of the day. They go and spend the day together. And then when it's dinner time, they all just head off home again. Well, there was something on the telly about
the
it.
You've seen
the
dog walkers in Buenos Aires with 20 or 30 dogs on the lead. On each hand, they're literally walking 60 dogs.
Can I give you another
look at that on the internet? You will find that.
Another recommendation, Lisa, for when you go next year.
There are a few
pilgrimages that you have to go on. Clearly, one of them is El Condor. The other is the Porto de Lago, just to experience Rally HQ. But the third is the Stadium Mario Kempes in Cordoba, because not only. Is it the site of Matthew Wilson's greatest ever single stage performance? Well, I think he won the stage there one year, but it is also where the greatest goal in the history of the World Cup was scored by Archie Gemmill in 1978 against Holland.
And they're few and far between those Scottish World Cup glory.
Well, that was the most glorious moment in our World Cup history, where we very nearly knocked Holland out of the World Cup. The interesting story about that is that Archie Gemmill is a bit of a god in Cordoba, because Scotland were based in Cordoba that year, and a massive number of Scotsmen went out there. They reckon somewhere in the region of 20,000 to 25,000. Now, Argentina might as well have been on the moon for Scots people in Glasgow. It was that far away and that difficult to get to in 1978. And somehow, 20-odd thousand Scotsmen got to Cordoba. Archie Gemmill scored that goal, and he's more or less treated like as a god there. And I did actually see him in the service park one year, about 7 or 8 years ago. But the interesting thing is, 20,000 Scotsmen went out, only 10,000 came home. 10,000 Scotsmen, they reckon, decided Cordoba.
What do you think
with
you're eating, Colin?
With its Malbec, with its steaks, with its beautiful, beautiful people, was a far better option than Glasgow. So they stayed out in Cordoba. So yeah, you have to go and visit the Scots diaspora, at least, while you're out there, and a little pilgrimage to Stadium.
I think there's a There's a theme there for Scottish football fans. There's all the lines of Lisbon. I think there's a huge part of Portugal following the Aberdeen going to against Lisbon in the European Cup.
Well, I think was it Porto? Lisbon Lions, wasn't it? Yeah, anyway. Celtic won that Lisbon, one, but that was a long time ago.
Anyway, we have run out of time, but that was fantastic. And I am going to have to wait another 12 months for a chance to experience the one and only Rally Argentina. Now, if this podcast has just whetted your appetite for more things Argentina, check out dirtfish.com for more tales of Argentinian action. And you can get in touch with us at Dirtfish Rally. But for now, that's it from us. Make sure you subscribe, though, to get your next fix of Spin the Rally Pod. Colin Clark, how can people subscribe? Where can they find
we're
us?
We're on all good podcast platforms. So iTunes, for example, just put either Dirtfish or Spin the Rally Pod into your search engine on your podcast platform and subscribe. And in that way, you won't miss a single episode. It'll just download into your podcast Dropbox or whatever it is you're using. So, yeah, just Google it or search it in your podcast platform, Lisa, and it's there waiting for you.
It is, and it's not just the four of us yabbering on as well. We've got other great podcasts up there, including if you want to relive the action from Safari 96, then you can listen to a fantastic interview that David Evans has done with Derek Dauncey. And, if you want to find out what white meat is in China, you really want to tune in to that podcast before you head out there. It's a great listen. It's a really great listen.
Unfortunately. So I sort of stared at him for a while, and then we went to shake hands, and he went to do that really cool handshake, you know, the one that rally drivers always do now. And I went for a very formal English handshake. Oh, man. It was just, my toes are curling at that memory.
David, but for me, were you wearing cords and a V-neck sweater as well?
A look.
Almost certainly, Colin. Almost certainly.
It would have been cold there, Colin. I fear not.
But yeah, not my finest hour with Carlos, but undoubtedly one of Carlos's own finest hours.
Well, there's an enduring
and
image.
That was it. Yeah, sorry.
Lise, can I just have one more little story? One more little story just on zebras. Oh, one more on zebras.
I'm watching the clock, but yes,
David talking about zebras reminded me of the time that I was there. One of the stories I can actually tell from zebras was the time that Phil Pugh, because Phil Pugh was there with, who would you have been
Guy
with,
Wilkes.
David? With, yeah, absolutely. And he'd been into zebras. He'd had a few.
Sorry, with who?
With what's his name?
Guy Wilkes.
No, no, Phil. Yeah, Guy Wilkes. Yeah, of course, Guy Wilkes. So I think they'd finished second on Rally Argentina. It was 2010. They'd finished second when it was IRC days. So obviously Phil had a few to drink. We're in zebras. I turned up. Now, I don't wear V-neck Marks and Spencer sweaters. I had my finest Ralph Lauren shirt on, David. Finest. It was brand spanking new.
Copy.
I'd spent some money on it, and I never spend money on clothes. I always get them from secondhand shops or from factory outlets or whatever. I'd spent some money on this shirt. Pugh staggers across to me and says something unintelligible about me having a fine chest, couldn't see enough of it, ripped my shirt open, taking every single button off. Every single button off. And to this day, there are pictures of me in that nightclub with my shirt tucked in, with my chest out, looking, a little bit peeved, I'd have to say. That's one of the probably more tellable stories from nights out in zebras. It was a hell of a place.
But it used to be, there used to be an early flight from Cordoba up to Buenos Aires. And you used to get so many people that literally packed their bag, left it in reception, and then went straight from zebras to the airport. And my good Lord, the state of some of those people on the flight. It was comical.
You know, the best trick for the winter flights out of Cordoba is never to take the first flight out of Cordoba. You take the second one. Yeah. So what happens is the first flight is sitting there and it can't take off because it's sat there overnight. Mm. The second flight arrives, clears away some of the dust, but the first pilots have now run out of hours, so they've got to go for their coffee break. Very often, most often, the second flight is several hours ahead of the first flight. Sometimes they cancel that first flight and they reschedule it to the 11 o'clock flight. So
that's another note to make to myself.
Second flight. Don't take the first one, take the second one.
We found a way around that, though, Cole, didn't we, by going out on Sunday night?
Yeah, Sunday night.
Then you That's not a bad play, that one, actually.
Yeah.
Well, they can't handle the nightclub action.
No. Seems like
clearly. Never could. Never could. Really.
That's it for us, though, for this edition of Spin the Rally Pod. Make sure you subscribe, whichever platform you're hearing us on, iTunes, all of them. Let's take that out. Whichever platform you're listening to us on, make sure you subscribe, and then the next edition will just pop into your phone or your audio device that you're listening on, and you'll just be able to push play. And I think we're talking volcanoes next, lads. But for now, see you later.
Bye.